As an experiment, I thought I'd just sit back and talk about my trip to China to try to give some idea of the experiences to share with you, but also to help me to understand exactly what I saw. I waited to do this because coming back from China, we brought back some stomach flu that left me less interested in talking about things like that for a while. The first experience on landing in Shanghai was descending through a thick red smoke. It was terrible to see, although I know that we get some of that same smoke drifting over California. The people from the university picked us up and took us to the hotel where we were staying. It seemed like we were going to a almost sleepy college town, old, very old college town, about 2 hours from Shanghai. Later, we found out that although the part of the city where we were was very old and with a large number of canals. In fact, the city, Suzhou is often referred to as the Venice of China. All the buildings around us were very, very old with narrow, narrow alleyways to walk through. Later we found out, when we asked about the population of the city, it had a mere 6 million people, although another 3 to 6 million people, depending upon whom we asked, were not counted because they did not have registration papers. The next morning we went to the university, where we were treated absolutely magnificently, almost as if we were important people. There was John Cobb, a theologian and expert on Alfred North Whitehead, and his son Cliff Cobb, both of whom were wonderful people. There was two theologians who had studied under John Cobb. Then there was Sean Sayers from England, a man from France whose name escapes me now, and John Bellamy Foster, with whom I had a wonderful experience getting to know a little bit better, along with his wife, Carrie Ann. We were given a luxurious breakfast before going to the university, where we met with a relatively small group of Chinese and some Korean professors, as well as a number of students. We were supposed to give 45-minute talks, but for some reason the Chinese Communist Party requisitioned the university, so our time was cut to a day and a half instead of a 3-day conference, and the time we were given to speak was cut to 15 minutes. We each gave a little talk, and the other professors gave a little talk while the students sat around the table. Then we proceeded to lunch, another luxurious lunch, and that afternoon we were carted off to we continued the conference. The next morning we were carted off to another university. We sat around the table, only the Westerners, and gave a few remarks, and then were asked very interesting questions by the professors from the second university. As soon as this was finished, we were taken out for dinner, not leaving us much time, not leaving us any time at all to talk with the various professors. The next day, we went to a garden, a magnificent garden, which made me wonder about what sort of crime the owner of the garden would have done to have been able to move nature the way he did. And then, after another luxurious lunch, we went to another university and gave another talk. Now, I mention these luxurious lunches because people told us that the way you show respect for somebody is you give them more food than they could eat. And they would bring course after course. Before one plate was finished, they would bring another plate. The dinners all ended, and the lunches all ended, with slices of watermelon. And all of us would anxiously wait for the watermelon to come to complete the meal. The professors we met were quite interesting. Most of them were not particularly open about criticizing the government, but they did ask critical questions and were very, very anxious to find out whatever they could to help them understand what to do, not only about the crisis, but also about the environment, which was a matter of great concern to them. They seemed to be very, very serious, very well educated, and very receptive. At the same time, one of the things that I came away with was the idea that the Chinese government was doing much, much more to try to alleviate bad conditions than I had realized. At the same time, the conditions were quite bad. Our last day in Shanghai, Blanche and I went out for a walk that lasted probably less than 45 seconds because the air was so foul that it didn't make sense to continue any longer. The environment needs a great deal of work, and the economy is in very bad shape. Just this morning I was listening to a discussion on NPR about the free fall in Shanghai real estate, and this kind of downturn seems almost inevitable when you look at the enormous number of construction cranes wherever you look, whether it was in Suzhou or whether it was in Shanghai. I was not as impressed with the Shanghai real estate, the lavish buildings, as many people were. There was very, very interesting architecture, but it just seemed like excessive. And from what I know, large buildings are an excellent indicator of a crash in the making. But the energy of the city was palpable. On the other hand, walking or riding a bike or doing anything, it seems to be a very, very risky thing to do. That is, the whole transportation system, including pedestrians, seem to be playing a constant game of chicken, one in which you take your life in your hands no matter what you do. Red lights seem to mean you should slow down a bit sometimes. I saw very few traffic police. In fact, we were struck by the absence of police in general. The city was much less policed than any American city that I have seen. Our Chinese hosts told us that their experiences in America were quite like ours, they were surprised by the number of police that they saw in American cities. Hearing this, you might expect me, an economist, to offer some sort of great insights into the Chinese economy. I don't think I could do that because, first of all, the impression that we got was the Chinese economy was much more complex than I had imagined. In addition, the Chinese economy is big. Everything about China seemed big. Mid-sized cities with millions and millions of people. Shanghai seemed to go on forever and ever without any indication whatsoever of urban planning. The system is pretty chaotic. The central government can make very, very good laws. Then the local governments get to interpret the laws. Because the local governments are unfunded, they have to make money, and the way they do often is on deals with business. Land can be confiscated at low prices and then sold to developers at mid-sized prices, giving surplus profits to the local authorities as well as a bargain to the corporations or developers who buy it. Some of the things that the Chinese are doing to stimulate the economy, like lowering prices on automobiles, seems counterintuitive with the traffic problem being so bad, and even more, the pollution problem being so bad. At the same time, the Chinese stimulus package is much bigger than that in the U.S., and it does not seem to be directed toward finance nearly as much as the United States. Rather, it seems to be directed toward what the liberal Democrats have been asking for, more of an infrastructure program. I was fascinated by Chinese calligraphy, even though I don't know anything about Chinese or calligraphy. But people showed me some of the characters and where they came from. The calligraphy indicates how precarious life must have been before the Communist Revolution. Before I continue with this, let me just say that you get the obvious impression that very few Chinese acknowledge how much the Chinese Revolution contributed to the prosperity today. In fact, what it looks like is that much of the prosperity today, and certainly not all, owes a great deal to the ability of capital to come and pluck the low-hanging fruit that was left by the previous socialist government. But anyway, back to the calligraphy. The symbol for happiness was something that showed a field and some cloth and a roof, and it seemed to say you should be happy if you can feed and clothe yourself. The word for family was a combination of a roof and a pig, again showing that food was a central preoccupation of the people. Let me close just by saying that China has enormous challenges that it has to meet. It has relatively few resources compared to the population that it carries. The fertile land is mostly near to the seacoast, and the further west, west you go, the more and more barren the country becomes, barren or mountainous or desert-like. So China has tremendous, tremendous challenges that it has to meet. But judging by the students that I met, they were very, very impressive. I would be somewhat optimistic about the future of China, and I'd look forward to being able to go back again.